Today is Tuesday, June 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Ethiopia orders an immediate and unconditional ceasefire in its northern Tigray region.
The government also called civil and the military actors at all levels to have the ceasefire and contribute to peace and stability.
Plus, what do we know about the Delta variant of the novel coronavirus?
And it is perhaps as much as 40 to 60% more transmissible than the Alpha.
These stories and more next. Ethiopia's government announced an immediate and unconditional ceasefire Monday evening after 8 months of conflict in the northern Tigray region. The announcement came shortly after government personnel fled the regional capital of Mukalla, where the Tigray People's Liberation Front entered the city. According to reports by the AFP, local residents celebrated in the streets. Reporter Junze Ayana is in Addis Ababa, and I began our conversation by asking him about the timing of the ceasefire announcement.
Normally, the ceasefire calls were requested by the interim administration of the Tigray region that currently administering the region. And the interim administration, Dr. Abraham Belai, has called for the ceasefire in light of the upcoming rainy season agricultural activity. According to Dr. Belai, the decision for the call of the ceasefire has come from this continuous conversation and consultation with representatives of the community in the region, regional and zonal administration officials, the scholars of the Tigray region, and also some other social segments from the ethnic group. So, the aim of this ceasefire, he said, is to facilitate a conducive environment for agricultural activities and an ongoing humanitarian aid in the region. To the response of this request or call, the government also announced that it accepts the ceasefire call and just declare the ceasefire that in that region from right now. The government also said that this is a question of the people of Tigray for peace and the development, with respect to already starting agriculture and ongoing humanitarian aid. However, although the government accepted the call for ceasefire, the activity that underway to bring the major perpetrators or those the government called criminals into justice will be continued, the government said. So the government also called civil and the military structures at all levels to adhere the ceasefire and contribute to peace and stability in the region. Not only this, the serious law enforcement or action measures will be vowed against anybody who will try to exploit the ceasefire for malicious agenda or for their own agenda, the government said.
Junze, this tentatively puts an end to nearly 8 months of fighting in Tigray. The TPLF has reportedly entered the regional capital of Mukalla. Has there been any posted comments or statements by the TPLF after the ceasefire was announced?
Up to now, there is no any reaction from TPLF for the ceasefire announcement from the government. I hope some ideas or opinions or some point of views will be announced it in the future. So right now, up to now, there is no any reaction or any opinion provided from this group about what is going on in the country about the ceasefire.
Likewise, I wanted to ask you about Eritrea. Eritrean forces were also involved in the fighting within the Tigray region. Has the government there or any spokesperson said that Eritrean forces will abide by the ceasefire or how they are reacting to it?
For now, the Ethiopian government also said nothing about the Eritrean troops or groups and military. Just the government already react or answer to the call ceasefire. On the other side, when the Eritrean government has said nothing about the ceasefire, and also like the TPLF groups, the government, if it is concerned and just if it takes into consideration the ceasefire, the Eritrean government will say something in the future.
Jonze Ayana spoke to me from Addis Ababa. The coalition to defeat ISIS said on Monday that some 8 million people have been freed from the militant group's control in Iraq and Syria, but the threat from ISIS fighters remains there, as well as in Africa. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden explains what's next for the coalition.
That's actually a very good question. The focus that they're talking about, that the Italian foreign minister, Luigi Di Maio, spoke about mostly in that U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, spoke about as well, although not in much detail, is looking at the threat of the Islamic State as it's expanding and growing across the African continent. And this isn't exactly new. It was late 2019 when then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo first started talking about the need to expand the coalition's focus beyond Iraq and Syria to Africa. Now, though, there seems to be support from within the coalition to formally establish an African task force to look at the expansion of Islamic State affiliates in the Sahel, in Western Africa, and across the continent, where there have been signs that they're gaining in strength, gaining in influence. And it's something that ISIS Corps has been pointing to show that even though perhaps the territorial caliphate in Iraq and Syria is no more, that ISIS is, in ISIS's own words, remaining and expanding.
Now, in terms of remaining and expanding and the emphasis on Africa, did the coalition identify any partners that may take up a lead in drafting what their next step would be?
A very good question, for which there are no answers as of right now. The United States especially has been talking about the idea of whatever it does in Africa when it comes to counterterrorism, of being by, with, and through local partners. That's been the model that they've emphasized in Syria, with the backing of the Syrian Democratic Forces against Islamic State. And that's what they've been emphasizing in their interactions in Africa, whether it's against groups like the Islamic State or in Somalia against al-Shabaab, backing the Somali forces in that instance. In this case, for this African task force, we're not quite sure what it's going to look like. The communique from the coalition noted that of the new members of the coalition, three of them, the Central African Republic, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Mauritania, they're from Africa. They've now joined the global coalition. Also, three other African nations, Burkina Faso, Mozambique, and Ghana, attended the ministerial as observers. So they point to building more buy-in from countries in Africa to take part in this counter-Islamic State initiative. But how exactly it's going to play out remains to be seen. Which countries have forces that are stable enough and strong enough that can take backing from the United States or other Western countries like France and then turn that into action or progress on the ground against Islamic State branches and affiliates is a big question. And France, which had been very active in parts of the Sahel in Mali, announced earlier this month that it is pulling back from its counterterrorism mission there and saying local countries and others need to do more. So who will be doing more, how it will happen is a big question. And two, we've yet to hear from the United States military, which has been doing an ongoing posture review about what it will do with its forces on the African continent. There have been suggestions that there could be some more withdrawal of U.S. forces as they put more of the onus on local forces. And again, analysts and experts say the question there is, how capable will these forces be? In some areas where you've had Western troops pull out, you've seen an acceleration of activity by terrorist groups, whether it's with ISIS or those backed by al-Qaeda.
Jeff, what about concerns about ISIS in its traditional home in the Middle East?
Well, one of the things that U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in his comments after the meeting was that while it's important to focus on what's going on in Africa and the spread of Islamic State there, it is also important for the coalition to keep its eye on what's going on in the core area of Iraq and Syria. And this meeting comes, almost a year to the day of the anniversary of the announcement in June 2014 by the Islamic State that it had established the caliphate in Iraq and Syria. That area is still of prime concern to the U.S. and other Western countries. For one part, they say in Syria, intelligence officials say in parts of Syria where the U.S. and coalition members are not able to reach, in other words, in areas that are still nominally controlled by the Syrian government and its Russian allies, that ISIS has managed to revive and even thrive, that they're still able to take, ISIS is still able to take advantage of empty spaces in Syria and in Iraq. There's still concern about the 10,000 ISIS fighters, including some 2,000 foreign fighters that are being held by U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces, a situation that Secretary of State Antony Blinken said was untenable. And he said there is some urgency. There's a need for other countries, especially with the foreign fighters, to repatriate them, to prosecute them, or to rehabilitate and reintegrate them where appropriate. There hasn't been a lot of movement on that, even though that's been a persistent concern. And there's also concern about what's going on in Afghanistan, where U.S. forces are in, you know, more than halfway through in terms of their withdrawal from that country. There have been numerous intelligence assessments, both by the U.S. and by U.N. member states, that the Islamic State province there, IS Khorasan, has the ability not just to threaten stability in Afghanistan itself, but also the larger region.
Jeff Selden is VOA's national security correspondent. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. While the world has been dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic for more than a year, the Delta variant is increasingly becoming a concern. To learn more about what is known about the quickly spreading version of the novel coronavirus, and more importantly, where knowledge gaps exist, I spoke with Associate Professor of Virology and Vaccinology at the University of Connecticut, Paolo Verardi.
Sure, let me go back a little bit. As you may recall, the Delta variant was first identified in India, and that was at the end of March. It was initially characterized as a double mutant variant, not because it only had two mutations, because in reality it has more than that, but because it has two key mutations in the spike protein of the virus. The spike protein is the one responsible for the virus attachment to cells. So that's why those are key mutations. So these key mutations, they make the virus even more transmissible than the Alpha or the UK variant that became the dominant strain in the US here earlier this year. And it is perhaps as much as 40 to 60% more transmissible than the Alpha variant. And remember that the Alpha variant was already more transmissible than the original SARS coronavirus 2. So Delta is indeed significantly more transmissible, and that's one key difference. It is possibly also associated with more severe disease and increased risk of hospitalization. However, that's not absolutely, you know, very clear right now. And of course, now we have, you know, the so-called Delta Plus variant, which is derived from the Delta variant itself. It has an additional mutation that affects that spike protein. But in reality, we don't know much about this new subvariant yet. You know, we can't really say that it's going to be worse than the Delta variant that it derives from.
So that's what we know. You alluded a little bit to what we don't know about the Delta variant. But as a virologist and a vaccinologist, what do you think is the most pressing concern in terms of learning more about the Delta variant?
And in terms of the virus itself, we should expect sort of a limit on how much the virus can improve its ability to enhance its transmissibility. And that's because, you know, the virus still needs to be fit. There's so much that the virus can change without compromising other functions that the virus has to do to be able to, you know, replicate successfully. So my hope is that we are approaching that limit at this point, at least as far as transmissibility goes. I think we know we are reaching the limit, so to speak, of how well the virus can improve its transmissibility without affecting, you know, other components of the virus life cycle. And that seems to be perhaps, you know, the good news, but we don't know yet. You know, that is one of the unknowns as well. We don't know yet. It is possible that, you know, different combinations of mutations may improve transmissibility even more. The reality is we don't know. We expect to be reaching that limit right now.
Time and time again, healthcare professionals have said that vaccinations and vaccination programs is the key to putting the pandemic behind us. What do we know about the efficacy of the coronavirus vaccines on this Delta variant?
Okay, so obviously everybody wants to know if vaccines are working against the Delta variant and potential new variants, right? And the good news is that vaccines still provide adequate protection against the Delta variant. Obviously, we are hearing about breakthrough cases where vaccinated people actually end up getting COVID, but majority of those people are protected from severe disease. The greatest majority is protected, you know, from death, so they're not going to die from COVID. So that is really the great news.
That is great news if you are able to obtain a vaccine. However, as the WHO said, there is vaccine inequality in the world.
So the reality is that we are really living in different worlds, right? So we have, you know, a situation in certain countries like the U.S. where we are able to offer vaccines to pretty much everyone that wants to have one, although not everybody wants to have one. And, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, we have places where people, you know, are desperate and really want to get a vaccine, but don't even have a chance, don't have access to those vaccines yet. I think we are close to vaccinating or to distributing about 3 billion doses of the vaccine, you know, worldwide, which is really very, very significant. But that distribution is not equal. And that is a problem, right? So that's something that needs to be fixed. And the reality is that for a more transmissible variant, in the absence of herd or community immunity, which is, you know, achieved by vaccines, those measures that we learned so much to hate are still our best tools to avoid new outbreaks. I'm talking about things like social distancing, masks, avoiding crowds, that type of thing. And for a variant like the Delta variant that's much more transmissible, you know, it's a certain level of social distancing and masking was able to contain you know, for example, the Alpha variant, we're going to have to go a step up to be able to contain the Delta variant. So, you know, it's kind of sad news for everybody because we are still going to have to be considering social distancing, masking, avoiding crowds and all of that stuff, regardless of having access to vaccines or not. Until we reach that level of herd immunity or community immunity, that really will break those cycles of transmission. That won't really allow, you know, those cycles of transmission to cause an outbreak. And we sadly are not there yet. We may be very close to that in certain places. For example, certain states here in the northeastern of the U.S. where we have a very high rate of vaccination. But we are definitely not close to that in some of the other states. And if you look worldwide, that's you know, we are very, very far from that goal.
Paolo Verardi teaches at the University of Connecticut, where he's an associate professor of virology and vaccinology. Leaders of Turkey and France are pledging to ease tensions after months of trading insults, but tensions between them remain over their competing interests in Africa. Dorian Jones has that story.
French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian declared Turkey and France are in what he described as a recovery period after the French and Turkish presidents met on the sidelines of the NATO summit earlier this month and pledged to resolve their differences. French President Emmanuel Macron and Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan had engaged in a war of words as the two leaders competed for international influence. Sinan Ulgen of the Istanbul-based Center for Economics and Foreign Policy Studies says there's been a diplomatic breakthrough, but he voices caution.
We can talk about a reset with France, but it's a question about how deep that reset will go. This is actually part of a broader reset that Turkey has been trying in terms of its foreign relations with the West. However, none of the areas of disagreement with France have been resolved.
Libya remains a crucial point of tension. France and Turkey back rival sides in the Libyan civil war, and Paris is at the forefront of an international call for the withdrawal of Turkish troops from the North African country. Last year, Turkish and French warships almost clashed off the shores of Libya over French claims that Turkey was violating a Libyan arms embargo. But Ulgen says both countries now recognize the need for diplomacy.
There's a realization both in Ankara and Paris that some progress can be achieved if the two are less confrontational and work diplomatically towards some sort of negotiated formula.
A Turkish presidential advisor has suggested France and Turkey could extend cooperation beyond Libya to the rest of Africa to contain China's growing influence. Ankara is building up its presence on the continent, especially in the Sahel region. But Turkish moves to develop ties with former French colonies like Niger and Mali is causing alarm in Paris, says Jalel Hajawi, a senior fellow at the Geneva-based Global Initiative. Hajawi says the Sahel could become an increasing point of tension rather than cooperation.
There's a real rivalry. There's an actual competition in the Sahel because Turkey wants to be present militarily. It is already very present diplomatically, and it's very ambitious commercially. And we're talking about a time horizon of 15 years or 30 years. So if France sees an adversary in that, I think that France is correct because there's not enough room for both former colonizers of the area.
For now, both French and Turkish presidents appear interested in downplaying their differences. But that could change with next year's French presidential elections, where the role of Islam in French society is a campaign issue. Erdogan portrays himself as a defender of global Muslim rights and has in the past accused Macron of Islamophobia, an issue Erdogan also uses for leverage in majority Muslim African countries, much to Paris's unease. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Voice of America's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A day after the U.S. conducted airstrikes near the Iraq-Syria border, American troops have come under rocket attack. Associated Press Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has more.
President Biden says he ordered yesterday's strikes on sites used by Iranian-backed militias.
Responsible for recent attacks on the U.S. personnel in Iraq.
The militia groups called for revenge, and today the military says U.S. forces in eastern Syria were attacked by multiple rockets. An American spokesman in Baghdad says there were no injuries and that troops fired on the rocket-launching positions in self-defense. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The death toll has risen to at least 11 as rescue crews searched for a fifth day after a condominium building collapsed in Miami, Florida. AP correspondent Shelley Adler has this update.
Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava shared the news on the latest death toll after another body was found this morning.
The total number of those accounted for is now 135. And the total unaccounted, 151.
The chairman of the Miami-Dade County Board of Commissioners, Jose Diaz, visited with the families of the missing.
The pain in their face, their expressions, it's not unlike anything I've seen before.
I'm Shelley Adler.
A UN report examining systemic racism suffered by people of African descent is calling for an end to impunity for human rights violations by law enforcement and for accountability and compensation for victims. The report by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights was mandated by the Human Rights Council in June of 2020 in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
The report cites the case of George Floyd, a black man killed by a police officer in Minneapolis, as a moment of reckoning, not only for the United States, but other nations. It says the mobilization of movements such as Black Lives Matter and the proliferation of demands for racial justice have pushed this issue to the forefront of the political agenda in many countries. UN investigators examined more than 190 cases of deaths at the hands of law enforcement officials, most in the United States, but also in numerous countries across South America and Europe. Mona Rishmawi is chief of the UN Human Rights Office Rule of Law, Equality, and Non-Discrimination Branch. She says investigators found striking similarities and patterns in all countries, including in the difficulties faced by families in accessing justice.
Here, we found worrying trends of associating blackness with criminality and other biases that shape the interaction of people of African descent with law enforcement and the criminal justice system. Our research shows that in a number of states, people of African descent are particularly vulnerable to racial profiling.
Rishmawi says this is used as a basis for discriminatory identity checks, stops and searches, and violence, including serious injury and deaths. She says the role of racial discrimination, stereotypes, and institutional bias are rarely considered when these deaths are investigated and brought before a court. She notes the killing of George Floyd is a rare exception in which anyone has been held accountable. Rishmawi says investigators have received many credible allegations about unnecessary and disproportionate use of force during anti-racism protests.
We are particularly worried about the use of military and militarized tactics in responding to protests in some states, and the use of surveillance tools and other technologies to monitor protests. The militarization of the police, coupled with inflammatory rhetoric against the media, made the reporting environment inherently more dangerous for journalists.
The report says the voices of people of African descent and those who stand up against racism must be heard and their concerns acted on. High Commissioner Michelle Bachelet is calling on states to show stronger political will to accelerate action for racial justice, redress, and equality through specific time-bound concrete actions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And finally, in Alaska, the Homer Ice Racing Association has been organizing car races across a frozen lake every weekend for its members as well as spectators since 1955. Mariana Brooks from the organization spoke to VOA about her beginnings in ice car racing.
My first ever race was in a pink Ford Pinto, and they called it the Pink Pony. I was driving with my dad in town, and we drove past Beluga Lake, and we see these cars out on the lake. We tear on down. What's going on? What is this? We go down there. There's a sign. It says they're broadcasting on the radio. So we turn it on. Now we're listening. We're watching, and we're just riveted, staring over the dash, just loving it. This is so cool. Coolest thing I've ever seen. And then it says on the radio, we're looking for kid racers. I didn't dare hope. Nobody wants me to drive their car. Come on. I'm just a girl, a young girl. I don't really know anything. Yeah. My dad says, well, let's just go. So we go in, and now I'm nervous. I'm afraid. But I walk in, and all of a sudden, every car driver is just leeching onto me. Come to my car. No, come to my car. Come try my car. And it was really a confidence boost. It felt very cool that they didn't care. They didn't care that I was young or I didn't know anything or that I was a girl doing what was supposed to be a man's sport. And so I walked in, and they said, hey, can you drive a stick shift? And I said, sorta. And they said, great, and shoved me in a car. It was incredible. I went out there, and I ran the entire race in first gear because I couldn't reach the clutch. So on the weekday, I'm at home, but I'm working. My husband has his own job he must go and do. I do everything that it requires to take care of the kids in the house. Sometimes that's doctor appointments. And it's in the back of my mind during race season what I'm doing and what time we can spare. We have our meetings Friday nights, and that really just starts it. Now you're in race mode from 6 p.m. on until Sunday evening. If it's not family oriented, I don't want to be there. So if it's not family bonding, if you're not together and you're not having a good time, why do it? We have long-standing members that were there in the 50s that are still here, but now it's their children and grandchildren and sometimes great-grandchildren coming down and being part of the association, and that's what's going to help keep us see into the future. If my children decide that they don't want to ice race when their time comes, which is sooner than I'd like, then the association won't last. It'll just be me and my husband until we can't anymore, and then nobody else will take it up, and that's kind of a bummer. We get very lucky in living in Alaska where there are areas where you can take your kids and have them practice more or less. That's one of the reasons why I love racing and why I love bringing kids into the association, because they get drive time at a really young age in the safest environment that they can be in. We've got helmets, we've got lots of safety gear, we've got fire extinguishers, they're in an armored car, they're wearing sometimes five-point harnesses. They're in the safest location they could be for anything to go wrong. I feel like you don't get it until you get it. It seems to me like you're just putting money into something that's not really earning you anything other than a good time. But what else are you going to do on a Sunday afternoon with your whole family? What are we going to do?
And that's going to do it for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe,